So what I was going to do to begin with is to review. Who can remember the principles that we have gone over? And we've gone over a lot of things. And for those that weren't here, what we've done is gone into a lot of detail. However, there are some major overall principles that if we can remember these principles, it will greatly help us out. First of all, and if you want to write these down, these are very important to remember because it will help you with the whole idea of this idea of evolution. Animals change within their kind. That's microevolution, but not outside their kind. Macroevolution. Number two, Darwinian evolution is not founded on the four-tiered scientific method. Therefore, it's not scientific. Number three, to promote Darwinian evolution by gene mutations, the gene mutations have to meet three criteria. Number one, they have to be structural. Number two, they have to be beneficial. And number three, they have to be persistent, even though none have been documented. Also, who can remember the two things that we studied last week, the two major principles? Can anyone remember? Last week we looked at the geological column, the fossil record. What are the two major overall themes that we need to take home from the fossil column? Number one, the fossil column is composed all the way down at the bottom of 100 phyla of animals. Do they gradually appear up toward the top? No. All 100 phyla of animals appear at the very bottom of the fossil column in the Cambrian layer in something called the Cambrian explosion. Number two, as you go up the fossil column, you don't see gradual transition between animal species. You see what is commonly called stasis. That is the state of remaining the same. The animals do not change in the fossil column. So that's something we need to think about. Today we're going to talk about an alternative to neo-Darwinian evolution. And the story goes like this. The creationists since 1800 have been saying there are no changes in the fossils. There are no transitions. Well, finally some evolutions came to admit, you know what? There are no changes in the fossil. Niles Eldridge said it is not just single species that are in stasis. Virtually all the component species of regional ecosystems are evolutionarily stable. Often for how long? Millions of years. So these are the evolutionists even saying that for millions of years the animals didn't evolve. They stayed the same. Why? Because when you look at the fossil record, you see animal kinds that supposedly lived for millions of years without any change. Dr. Spencer Wirt said, it takes a while to see what one is not prepared to look for. That's exactly what we see here. From the year 1800 until, we're going to see until about 1972, the evolutionists denied or would not accept the fact that there are no changes in animals in the fossil record. So the story goes like this. Last 200 years, creationists have said there's no changes in animals, such as changes between animal families, such as the mammal families. We do not see transitions between different types of mammals. Darwinists, however, argue, well, we just need a little more time. If you just give us a little more time to dig into the geologic column and the fossil record, we will find those transitions. Well, the story went like this. After about 170 years of looking in the fossil record, they didn't find anything. In fact, if you go back to Darwin in 1870, Darwin said the number of intermediate and transitional links between all living and extinct species must have been inconceivably great. That is, there must have been a host of finely graduated changes, transitions between animals and fossil record. But do we find that? Do we find the supposedly evolutionarily predicted transitions between a reptile such as a snake and a bird? No, we don't see that in the fossil record. Darwin said, this is my greatest problem. He says, why is not every geologic formation and every stratum full of such intermediate links? He says, this is the most obvious and serious objection which can be urged against the theory. He says, that's my biggest problem. To date, in the fossil record, they have found 300,000 animal species have been discovered. However, there are no undisputed transitions between animal phyla, classes, orders, or families. We do not see the supposed fictional mythical transition between the bird and the reptile. That is, the reptile changing into the bird. It simply does not happen. Notice even Dr. David Raup from the Field Museum of Natural History in Chicago and at the University of Chicago said, in the years after Darwin, his advocates hoped to find predictable progressions. In general, these have not been found. Some pure fantasy has crept into textbooks. Now notice he goes on to say, the record of evolution is still surprisingly jerky. That is, we see different animal kinds, but we don't see the transitions. He said, ironically, we have even fewer examples of evolutionary transition than we had in Darwin's time. And how many transitions did Darwin have in his time? None! So the picture is starting to look like, you know what, we have to admit, there's no transitions. So they're going to have to do something about this. So finally, after all these decades, there enters what I call the confessing evolutionists. These were evolutionists who, they weren't going to deny evolution, but they were honest enough to say, there are no transitions in the fossil record. All we see are gaps. We are going to have to devise a way to explain away these transitions. And the big five, as I like to call them, are Schindewolf, Goldschmidt, Simpson, Gould, and Eldridge. Following them, some others in the 70s and 80s followed. These were Ayala, Grasse, Stanley, Verba, and Margulis. These are the more notable ones, even though there were many others. And the story goes like this. These guys finally came to the conclusion and admitted what the creationists have been saying since 1800. Even though they didn't say we were right, they did say, you know what? There are no transitions in the fossil column. So what are we going to do? Well, it starts out with a professor named Otto H. Schindewolf. He was the top paleontologist in Europe, director of the Geological Survey of Berlin. And he explained the lack of transitions in the fossils, and he gave it a name. He called it typostrophism. And it simply means this. It is something called, here's the alternative, saltational evolution. A saltation is a jump or a leap. So he says the evolution didn't happen slowly. It must have happened very rapidly, very quickly, in a saltation event. And it happened by systemic mutations in which the whole animal would be hit with dozens of mutations which would radically change it from one form into another. Following in his footsteps was another German scientist by the name of Richard B. Goldschmidt, who was actually an immigrant to the U.S., brilliant geneticist at UC Berkeley. He admitted there is no transitions in the fossil record. And so what he did is he followed in O.H. Schindewolf's footsteps, and Goldschmidt said he's going to propose a model, and it was called the Hopeful Monster Model. It was also a saltational evolutionary model, and the Hopeful Monster Model said that you would have macro mutations or gross mutations in one animal. And here's the example he used. He said two reptiles may mate and lay an egg, and the egg would hatch, and out of the reptile egg would come a bird. Okay? Kind of funny? You're laughing? Well, that's what the rest of the scientific community did too. They laughed this poor guy to his grave. Goldschmidt died being, just made fun of. And still laughing. Till today, I was reading something last night from a contemporary scientist. You know, who can imagine that just a bird would hatch from a reptile egg? Ridiculous. Well, certainly it is. But at least he was willing to address the fact that there are no transitions in the animals in the fossil column. I think part of it had to do with the fact that he was a German immigrant. And maybe the language didn't translate just right. I think if he had suggested this theory in his native language, instead of using something like hopeful monsters, it would have been something that maybe articulated the idea a little better without seeming so science fiction. Because the idea of hopeful monsters in our minds, you know, picture something like this, a monster. Well, anyway, that was in 1940. In 1944, a man who has been called the most influential paleontologist of the 20th century suggested the same thing. So first we had O.H. Schindewolf in Germany, who was the top paleontologist in Germany. And now we have the most influential paleontologist of the 20th century suggesting the same thing. George Gaylord Simpson was one of the 11 people who were responsible for developing the modern synthesis of evolution, which started in 1937 and throughout the 40s. So George Gaylord Simpson renamed this. He was at Columbia University. He got rid of hopeful monsters and typostrophism, and he said, we're going to call it quantum evolution. The evolution happened very quickly, not gradually and slowly. Of course, he was laughed at too. In the 1960s, and he taught that to the 40s and 50s, finally by the 1960s, even the Soviet scientists in the Soviet Union said, you know what, when we dig into the fossil record, we don't see transitions between animals. And so guess how they explained it? They said, creation must be true, right? No, they didn't say that. They didn't want them and their family to be shipped off to Siberia to starve to death. So instead they said, well, the evolution must have happened so quickly that it's not recorded in the fossil record. The same thing these other guys were saying. This gets us up to the present era, really. By the 1970s, a couple of individuals who we'll spend the rest of the lesson on today, Dr. Stephen Jay Gould from Harvard University and Niles Eldridge, who's now at the American Museum of Natural History, who studied at Columbia University, came up with a similar idea. And the story goes like this. Niles Eldridge, when he was doing his doctoral work at Columbia University, studied for his time there the ancient trilobite, which is an arthropod, an animal similar to this crustacean here that lives in the oceans. And the arthropod had a very complex eye. In many ways, its eye is even more superior to the human eye in some aspects, just like the eye of the fly is in some aspects. You can see here a micrograph, a close-up of this eye. So he studied the eyes, and he found out that over millions of years, you know, he was told in class, these animals must have evolved. So over millions of years, how did these eyes evolve? Do you know what he found? Over millions of years? First, these trilobites appear in the fossil record with the eye already being formed. Millions of years later, when they disappear, guess what the eye looks like? It looks the same. So he was in quite a conundrum. How does he explain this away? The eye doesn't change. Well, this is how he explained it. He said, you know what? It changes in the number of lenses. There's in between 13 and 18 lenses. Well, what have we studied so far? If it changes in number of lenses, that's only variation within an animal kind. I think there's more greater difference between a Chihuahua and a Great Dane than there is between a trilobite with 13 and 17 rows of lenses. So he was quite confused about this whole thing. So he graduated in 69, and in 1971, he published his findings. And in it, he suggested something called punctuated equilibria, which is a rapid change. And that's really what we're talking about today, this idea of punctuated equilibria. Sometimes it's shortened and called punc-eq or P-E. The next year, his colleague, Stephen Jay Gould from Harvard, they got together and they published the same paper with more information added. It was published in a book of papers, and it created a firestorm throughout the evolutionary community. The name of the paper was Punctuated Equilibria, an Alternative to Phyletic Gradualism. So instead of animals slowly evolving over time, they evolved very rapidly into a different animal in the fossil record. And it goes like this, just to help you understand the concept of PE. Look at this graphic of the fossil record here. So on the left, you see what evolutionists had told them previously, that animals gradually evolved, branching into different kinds. But when they looked in the fossil record, guess what they saw? Did they see these animals changing into different kinds? No, they saw this. In this graphic, there are 26 distinct kinds of animals. When the animals appeared in the fossil record, they looked exactly the same as when they became extinct. What model does this more accurately predict? The creation model, which says animals who escaped the ascending tides of the flood in different habitats and ecosystems, and animals that had the ability to climb higher, would have slowly started to be covered up and destroyed and finally become extinct. And so that's what we see in the fossil record. Now, what they say is that, well, between animal A here and animal B, there must have been evolution taking place. So this is what they do. Instead of saying that all animals are distinct, they say we have to draw a line between animal A and animal B and say that this one must have evolved to that one, even though we don't see it in the fossil record. Also, animal C must have evolved to animal D, and animal E must have evolved to animal F. Now, there's no proof of it in the fossil record, but it must have happened because evolution is true. So phyletic gradualism teaches this. This is neo-Darwinism. Animals evolve very slowly. This is what punctuated equilibrium teaches. It teaches the following. That evolution happened by animals staying in what we call stasis for a long period of time and then quickly evolving to another kind. So the idea of equilibrium is staying the same. Equilibrium goes on for millions of years, and then it's punctuated or stopped or broken by disequilibrium. And the evolution happens real quick. Do you remember earlier when we quoted from Niles Eldridge? And he said, the animals may be in stasis for millions of years. You know, we've been taught in school that evolution happens before our eyes. Always happens. And yet, the new paradigm that they are teaching, and I have here the... This was given to me when I was in South Carolina recently by a teacher there. Rich, could you fix this? I seem to have messed up the screen. So while Rich is fixing that, so this is the curriculum. These are the course requirements in order to graduate in the state of South Carolina. This is what students must know about evolution. And one of the things that they were required to know is punctuated equilibrium. Here's what they have to know. Periods of abrupt changes in species, thanks, after long periods of little change with the species over time. Now, I hope you see what's going on here. What's going on is they are trying to find a way to explain away the facts that they don't have proof for evolution in the fossil record. They're creating another idea. Let's look at some quotes here. This is from Stephen Jay Gould. 5 years after they published their article in 72, in 77 he wrote an article called The Return of Hopeful Monsters. I do, he says, however, predict that during the next decade, Goldschmidt will largely be vindicated in the world of evolutionary biology. The fossil record, with its abrupt transitions, offers no support for gradual change. How could we ever convert a rhinoceros or a mosquito into something fundamentally different? Yet transitions between major groups must have occurred in the history of life. Now, why does he say they must have occurred, even though we don't see them there? Because of his presuppositions. Dr. Gould is a committed and dedicated and professing Marxist, or he was. He passed away in 2002. And Marxism, of course, is founded on the idea of naturalism and materialism. And they say there is no God. Therefore, if there is no God, everything had to have been created naturally. Then all of this must have come about by evolution. Later in 1980, there's a paper. I actually have two articles. If anyone wants to read more on this subject, and I'll tell you what, when I first read about this when I was in grad school, about punctuated equilibrium, it just blew my mind. It was such a revelation to see how supposed scientific community could make up an idea that's totally unscientific and it be accepted. So what happened in 1980? Here's an article that was published in Science by Richard Lewin, who we've quoted before. In 1980, at the Field Museum of Natural History in Chicago, Illinois, they had a meeting with 160 of the leading experts of evolution in the world, paleontologists, anatomists, biologists, biochemists, and they discussed this idea. And Lewin says that the meetings were sometimes acrimonious. And there's another word. Basically, there were a lot of arguments going on. And you can imagine why. Because what stood to be risked was throwing away everything that had been taught since 1859 with Charles Darwin. That evolution doesn't happen slowly. It happens very rapidly. After this conference, Richard Lewin said, this is Francisco Ayala, who previously believed only in neo-Darwinism. He said, I am now convinced from what the paleontologists say that small changes do not accumulate. These small mutations that you're taught in school, animals have small mutations that eventually accumulate into great changes. Fast forward 1993, 13 years later. A lot happened in that time. We don't have time to talk about it. But basically, Eldridge and Gould risked becoming laughingstocks as Goldschmidt did. And because of that, they tried to salvage their name, and they kind of backpedaled here and there. And what they did, instead of rejecting neo-Darwinism entirely, they tried to mesh punctuated equilibrium with neo-Darwinism, which are two polar opposite ideas. One is evolution happens gradually. The other is evolution happens quickly. But notice what they said in their article, punctuated equilibrium comes of age in nature. PE, they say, has been accepted by most of our colleagues as a valuable addition to evolutionary theory. And notice this, paleontologists never wrote papers on the absence of change. in lineages before PE granted the subject some theoretical space. In other words, the people that dug up the fossils never admitted that they really didn't see any change. Well, what he fails to say here is evolutionary paleontologists, because there are plenty of creationist paleontologists who said there's no change in the fossil record. But notice what he says. Now that we've provided another idea, punctuated equilibrium, now the paleontologists are saying, oh, okay, there's no change in some fossils. Well, then how can you account for evolution? Well, punctuated equilibrium must have occurred. I went to a debate in 2005 in Georgia, in Jonesboro, between a creationist, Terry Mortensen, and a professor at the university. And Terry Mortensen had this guy pinned to the wall, and, you know, there was just no way around. He presented all the evidence that the fossils do not show transition. And guess what the professor said? Well, if it doesn't show in the fossil record, then they must have evolved by punctuated equilibrium. You see, that's the escape mechanism. If there's no evidence for it, then PE is the fairy godmother that comes in and rescues the idea. I corresponded also in 2005 with a professor at Queen's University in Montreal, Dr. Donald Forsyth, very brilliant scientist. So I asked him, because you're not going to see a lot of this in the text, because people don't want to risk being laughed at, but I asked him, what do scientists currently believe about Goldschmidt? You remember the hopeful monster guy that was laughed to his grave? This is what he told me. He said, Goldschmidt is becoming increasingly seen as on the right track regarding his evolutionary ideas. In other words, they'll tell you in correspondence and in private discussions, we know there's no transitions in the fossils. We know these guys must have been true before, but we're not going to admit it publicly. Well, here are the problems. This is the last third of the lecture. Here are the problems with PE. What are the problems? First of all, I contend that it's an unscientific, quote, jury-rigged affair. What it is, it's a wink and a nod. It's people saying, we know we don't have evidence for it, so we're going to come up with some other idea that saves our hypothesis. I would consider it like a rigged game. Have you ever played with someone that's not a good sport? Maybe, especially in childhood. And in the middle of the game, if they're not winning, what do? Sometimes the kids would change the rules. You know, worse, they would just walk off. They would get mad. I had a sibling, I won't say which one, but if it was ever clear in any game, it doesn't matter, Monopoly or cup ball or whatever it was, if it ever got to the point where he knew that there was no chance of him winning, he would immediately quit or start a new game. Well, unfortunately, the evolutionists won't even do that. They're not going to quit. They're going to keep going. They're going to change the rules to the game as they go along. This is a non-scientific affair. And so some other analogies I would like to use, or it's like a game of heads you win, tails I lose, or heads I win, tails you lose. You know, that kind of worked in kindergarten, first and second grade. When kids would say, okay, I'll play heads I win, tails you lose. When you flip the coin and it lands on heads, I win. Flip the coin, it lands on tails, you lose. And finally, by third grade, kids are like, no, I know. If you play that, then you're going to win every time and I'm going to lose. Well, that's what creationists are saying. We're going to lose every time and you're going to win because you changed the rules of the game. Other analogies, it's like playing with a stacked deck or marked cards. It's like playing with loaded dice or a corked bat or a fixed race or a palming trick or a shot-filled frog or Vaseline or an emery board in a glove or a two-headed coin or a shell game. Just when you pick the shell that you know that the pebble is under, it's under this shell. They shuffle around again and say, no, pick again. You pick the one with the right, the right show. No, pick again. That's exactly what happens. And I'll show you what I mean. Notice this quote we looked at before. This is from Dr. S.L. Washburn from Columbia University, or UC Berkeley. So he said, it may, and he is one of the top anthropological paleontologists, experts on the supposed evolution of humans in the 20th century. He said, it may be more useful to regard the study of evolution as a game rather than as a science. Let me first say, I'm quoting only exclusively from evolutionists in this lecture. These are all their admissions. There are no creationists quoted in this lecture. He goes on to say, uncertainties are far greater than might be thought from reading scientific papers. In spite of the emphasis on evolutionary theory, there is no agreement on the rules of the evolutionary game. So here are the problems with PE. Number one, the genetic mechanistic problem. First of all, PE actually relies on the modern synthesis of evolution. It uses no other mechanism. All it says is that the mutations must have happened more quickly in a shorter amount of time. Well, what's the problem with that? We've already shown that even over long periods of time, that the modern synthesis of evolution does not fit. If neo-Darwinism can't occur very slowly over long periods of time, then it's even less plausible it can happen in short periods of time, very rapidly, which is what PE requires. Can you understand that? I'll give you some quotes. These are some we looked at, but these are some of the modern scientists that says there is no way that mutations can create Darwinian evolution, lead to macroevolution. Lynn Margulis said, I have seen no evidence whatsoever that these changes can occur through the accumulation of gradual mutations. She said, Neo-Darwinism, which insists on the slow accrual of mutations by gene-level natural selection, is a complete funk. We recall the book, The Altenburg 16, a historic meeting that they tried to keep private in Altenburg, Austria, in which evolutionists from all over the world came together to say, we've got to come up with a new idea before the public catches on. So right now, there are people trying to synthesize a new idea for evolution. Margulis said, Darwin's claim of descent with modification as caused by natural selection is a linguistic fallacy. She says, the source of purposeful inherited novelty in evolution, the underlying reason the new species appear, is not random mutation. Twice she says, Neo-Darwinism is dead. Neo-Darwinism is dead. And just for those who weren't here, Lynn Margulis won the Darwin Wallace Medal. She is one of the absolute leaders in the world in evolution. She has no respect at all for creationists. She is the ex-wife of the late Carl Sagan. We looked at Dr. Lima DeFeria at the University of Lund, Pierre Paul Grasset. All of these individuals say Darwinian evolution cannot happen. Jerry Fedor, and then Kevin Padian at UC Berkeley. So the second problem is the time problem. So did PE happen in only a few thousand years, very shortly? Well, if it did, scientists admit that that would require too many mutations in a short period of time to create some kind of wild animals. They would be too mutated and not able to breed. The hopeful monster idea. Notice even Sewell Wright, he's another of the 11 individuals who are responsible for generating the modern evolutionary synthesis. He said, I have recorded more than 100,000 guinea pigs and have seen many hundreds of monsters of diverse sorts, but none were remotely hopeful, all having died shortly after birth. He says, sure, you can mutate an animal with a number of mutations, but it's not going to live. And if it does live, then what is it going to breed with? Point B in the time, or the second point in the time problem is, well, if it didn't happen slowly, now they say today, well, it must have happened in tens of thousands, or they even say millions of years. Well, what's the problem with that? If it happened in, let's say, 70,000 years, or a few million years, then there should be proof of it in the fossil record, right? Certainly. Certainly. We should see it there. But we don't. We don't see any intermediary species between animal phyla, class, order, or families. Point C, and I think this is the most damaging of all, the lack of evidence problem. And folks, this is one of the only major premises that I have ever heard of that's been widely accepted, widely taught in schools, as we just showed from the curriculum from South Carolina, biology and evolution, that is based and premised not on evidence, but on a lack of evidence. They say the fact that we don't find transitions in the fossil column is proof that animals must have evolved quickly. You see what's going on here? This isn't science. I say it's a duplicitous conundrum. Before PE, Darwin has said, well, we know evolution occurred. We just have to wait and find it in the fossils. After the transitions weren't found, they said, well, lack of change in the fossil record proves that evolution must have occurred. Do you know what this amounts to? It's not science. It amounts to faith. It's a faith that they have. And if you'll bear with me, I'm going to quote a little bit here. This is, and I have the book. I think I left it in the back. So this is from a book I have by Niles Eldred, if anyone would like to borrow it. And if you want to get a detailed view, it's not a very big book. It's about 250 pages, not fine, very small print, published in 1999. It's called The Pattern of Evolution. And in this book, he describes how they came up with this idea of punctuated equilibrium. And it is an absolutely contrived, unscientific idea. It's basically coming up, thank you, Art. So here's the book here, with an idea to explain away the fossil record. Now notice what he says, and I didn't have time to read all these, so I just highlighted a few quotes. He said, and this is when he goes back and describes when he was looking at the trilobites when he was in grad school as a PhD student. He said, whatever my pattern was showing, it didn't appear to be this mode of expected gradual change. He said, I didn't see any change in these trilobites. But notice what he says. It is the job of all PhD candidates to carry out original research. And he says, there is an unspoken assumption that positive results are expected. Well, maybe in his field, but in any other scientific field where the expectation is you perform the science and report the results, there's not pressure on someone to get the results that they want ahead of time. That's unscientific. But unfortunately, that's what happened to paleontology. Otherwise, they can't continue getting funds. Notice what he says. So, how then, Dr. Eldredge, how did you explain away the fact that there was no evolution in these trilobites? He says it was no thunderclap, just a realization that the absence of change itself was a very interesting pattern. So what he's saying is that previously change meant evolution, but now lack of change. That must mean something too. Well, certainly it means something. It means that the animals stayed the same, that creationism has a better argument. But notice what he says. But Gould has also said that stasis is data. What does that mean? The lack of change is data. Sure, it's data for us. It's data for the creationists, but let's continue. He says, and indeed it is. Dr. Eldredge, how do you explain that lack of change means evolution? He says, the trick to seeing stasis itself as a pattern required only a shift from equating evolution with change. I tell you what, I am not making this up. This is some of the craziest so-called science I've ever heard. So the whole idea is based on the fact that there's no change, that must mean evolution occurred. It didn't change, so it must have happened quickly. Exactly. Evolution means change. So that's the problem, and we'll get to that in a minute. So, very good point, Mark. Stasis has been another matter. He goes on to say, you know, everything stayed the same. Stasis is another matter. Notice this. Gould and I have explored a number of possibilities for why it happens, for why the animals don't change in the fossil record. Well, I wonder, have they considered creationism? Well, of course not. Gould is a Marxist and an atheist, and Eldredge walked in the feet of Julian Huxley, so that would never happen. So he says, which has led to charges that we are forever changing our minds. And if you go through their writings from 72 until 93, there's a great change. They go from punctuation, from saltationalists to neo-Darwinists again. But notice, he kind of gets upset and he responds this way to people who are criticizing him. He says, are paleontologists not supposed to dream up new mechanisms? You see, that's their job. He says, that's our job. We're supposed to come up with new mechanisms. Well, Dr. Eldredge, are you telling us that you don't have a mechanism for evolution? That you have to dream it up? That's exactly what he's saying. I'm not the first one to say this. here's someone who said it a long time ago. Dr. Larry Azar, who is today a professor emeritus at Iona College. Listen to what he says. I can understand the inherent difficulty in attempting to discover intermediate forms. He says it's not there in the fossil record. He said, but that's not my problem. My problem concerns the methodology of science. If an evolutionist accepts gaps, that is no change, as a prerequisite for his theory, is he not arguing from a lack of evidence? If a biologist teaches that between two existing fossils, there was an existing third, and perhaps several others, is he not really like the man of religious faith who says, I believe, even though there is not evidence? That's exactly right. He has hit the nail on the head. They are committed to their idea, even though there is not evidence in the fossil record, even though animals remain in stasis and disappear, they say they must have connected and evolved. We just have faith. So in conclusion, why the fossil record cannot prove evolution? We do not see transitions between any animal, phyla, class, order, or families. First of all, evolutionary paleontology is not based on science. It's based on subjective reconstructions of what a given scientist believed must have occurred in the past. And I emphasize that this is top-heavy and premised with presuppositions based on naturalistic worldviews. That is, they believed this even before they had any of the evidence. You can go back to 1800 and prove that. But don't hear it from me. I want you to hear it from another man who was one of the 11 who came up with a modern evolutionary synthesis, which began in 1937 by publication by Dobzhansky and then continued through the 40s. This is Dr. Ernst Mayr at Harvard University in 2004. Do you remember in previous lectures we've talked about historical narratives? That instead of using science, they just create historical narratives. They make up stories to explain the fossils. This is what he says. To obtain its answers, particularly in cases in which experiments are inappropriate, evolutionary biology has developed its own methodology, that of historical narratives or tentative scenarios. In other words, he says, they come up with hypotheses and they push them forward as truth and they teach them to children and college students. Then Gareth Nelson at the American Museum of Natural History in the Journal of Biogeography, he says the idea that one can go to the fossil record, and mind you, these guys are all evolutionists, okay? They believe in evolution, but they are just admitting what others are not willing to admit. The idea that one can go to the fossil record and expect to empirically recover an ancestor-descendant sequence, he says that you can take these fossils and prove that one led to the next, led to the next, led to the next, has been and continues to be a pernicious illusion. And finally, this is my last slide. So I'll ask you, so this is going to be a very well-known scientist. So if someone was considered a well-known scientist, they might publish in the most prestigious scientific journal in the world. Does anyone remember by impact factor what I've said the most prestigious scientific journal in the world is? Nature. Nature is number one, science is number two. Okay, now what about not only publishing in Nature, what if you publish multiple times in Nature, and you edited for Nature, and you were one of the editors for Nature? More than that, what if you were the senior editor for the most prestigious scientific journal in the world? This is Dr. Henry G., who by the year 2006 had already published over 100 times in the journal Nature. He's a paleontologist from Britain, but he does admit, he's honest enough to admit what he sees. He doesn't pull any punches here. He says no fossil is buried with its birth certificate. That and the scarcity of fossils means that it is effectively impossible to link fossils into chains of cause and effect in any valid way. And he says what it really is, a complete human invention created after the fact. In other words, he says, no one was there. We didn't see it happen. Shaped to accord with human prejudices. He says to take a line of fossils and claim that they represent a lineage is not a scientific hypothesis that can be tested. but an assertion that carries the same validity as a bedtime story. Amusing, perhaps even instructive, but not scientific. However, he doesn't doubt evolution either. They know it must have happened. They're just admitting some of the facts here with the problems with the scientific method in paleontology. Thank you for your attention. That concludes the lecture. And in conclusion, there's one more transitional fossil that we don't see today. Maybe by genetic engineering in the future, they'll be able to come up with a guy like that. So are there any questions or comments that anyone would like to make?
Can you go back through the first couple?
Let's see. Where did we start out at? So we started with a review. And you just want me to briefly give a thumbnail sketch through the first few slides? Okay, tell me when you came in. So first, Niles Eldridge said, animals are stable in the fossil record for millions of years. Next, Dr. Spencer Ware says it takes some people a while to see what one is not prepared to look for. In other words, they have presuppositions. For the last 200 years, creationists have said that macroevolution could not have occurred. Darwinists have said, we just need more time, more time. Charles Darwin said there must have been an inconceivably great number of transitional fossils. So between 1859 and the present, they've been looking for those fossils. Charles Darwin said, this is my biggest problem. Why are not every stratum full of these intermediate links? Today, there have been 300,000 different fossilized animal species discovered. However, there have been no undisputed transitions between phyla, classes, orders, or family. Now, I touched on this last week, and I'll just mention a little more since we have some time now. So the only one, and this is one way that Gould changed from 1972 to 1993. And it was largely, if you go into the history of it, this is very fascinating. I think the whole PE, the historical information, is just really cool. It's amazing how politics become involved. So Gould had this idea that, you know, there are no transitions. He says there are none. And then in 1981, he got roped into the McKean versus Arkansas court case that allowed equal time for creation and evolution to be taught in school. And they quoted him because he said you can't prove evolution from the fossils. And he was put on the witness stand, he was subpoenaed and had to testify, and he had so much pressure put on him by the community that he began to hedge a little bit, and finally he changed. He said, well, no, there are some transitions, and the one that he claims that is clear, and I wasn't able to cover it, but it's the whale transition from land mammal to whale. And that's the one that last week I said I even have problems with the intelligent design movement because they admit that that's a transitional sequence, which I do not believe that it is from land mammal to whale. So I still believe there's no undisputed fossils. David Ralph said this has produced pure fantasy in textbooks. He says there are even fewer examples of evolution transitions today than in Darwin's day. And how many did Darwin have? None. And then enter the confessing evolutionists. So the big five that finally admitted there's no transitions are Schindewolf, Goldschmidt, Simpson, Gould, and Eldridge, and there were many others. But the other prominent names that came later were Ayala, Grasse, Stanley, Verba, and Margulis. They agreed with the creationists in this sense. They said, yeah, there's no transitions, but we have to come up with a different idea to explain away. So Schindewolf was the top European paleontologist. And he explained it this way. So he knew more about fossils than anyone in Europe. And he said, there's no transitions. We don't see evolution. So he said, what must have happened is they must have evolved so quickly that they didn't get buried in the fossil record. And this is called saltational evolution. A saltation is a jump or a leap. There are many ideas. Basically, Goldschmidt and Schindewolf had a similar idea that there were just great systemic changes that just randomly happened. That one in every, 100 million animals. And the example that Goldschmidt used was two reptiles would get together, lay an egg, and a bird would hatch out of the reptile egg. You know, and of course, both of these guys were just, even though they were pretty high up in their fields, they were just laughed to scorn. And Schindelwolf called it typostrophism. And Goldschmidt, and I really think it had to do, and if you try to communicate with someone in a different language, and you're talking and you say something that they understand, and then everyone starts laughing at you because the meaning didn't get translated exactly correctly. It sounded strange. Some of my Chinese friends do the same thing. They say things that they're trying to say, but it just sounds very odd. I think the idea of hopeful monsters came from his, you know, English as a second language. He should have used a better idea than hopeful monsters, because even people that wanted to accept it, you're not going to accept this idea of hopeful monsters as a serious scientific idea. So he was at UC Berkeley. He's a very notable historical geneticist. Next in George Gaylord Simpson, he was the most influential paleontologist of the 20th century. He was at Columbia University, and he renamed it quantum evolution. And quantum means a large leap or a jump. And then the Soviet workers in the 1960s, they saw the same thing. There's no evolution taking place, but we don't want to get sent off to the Gulag or Siberia, so we'll say it must have happened so quick that we can't find the fossils. And then enter Gould and Eldridge. And you know, as much as I disagree with these guys and Gould and Eldridge, what's interesting about them is that they are honest enough. I don't think they have an honest interpretation of the evidence, but they are willing to look at the evidence and talk about it honestly. I think anyone else in Niles Eldridge's position may have come up with some grandiose idea when they looked at the trilobites. We've invented something like, well, I see some change here, and so that must prove evolution. And we see that throughout the history of paleontology. The Piltdown Man, the Brasca Man, all these different, you know, people working on their doctorates, they got to make up something. But he was willing to say, hey, it's not here. And so I give them credit for that. And unfortunately, Gould died in 2002. And, you know, you look at some of these guys and you appreciate the guts they have for what they're doing. And if you want to read something interesting, read Lewin's article in Science. In fact, I have two excellent articles there. If anyone wants to read more, the first one is Lewin's article in Science, and it recounts what took place at that historic meeting in Chicago in 1980. It was just very... So he said, the meetings were sometimes acrimonious and unruly. And then the other article is actually by a creationist. His name is Dr. Don Batten. He's either from Canada or Australia. And it's called Punctuated Equilibrium, Come of Age. It's very good, just an overview of the whole controversy from 72 until about the year 2000. And the third thing I have, if you want to see it, is this book, Niles Eldridge, The Pattern of Evolution. And reading through it, it's just hard to believe that some of this can pass as science. These guys are just making up stories. And, of course, if they're at the Ivy League universities, they come up with a new idea, the world's going to accept it, it's going to go straight into the textbooks. You know, straight from Cambridge, Massachusetts to, you know, Texas and California, and they include it in the textbooks, and the rest of the country includes it.
I mean, not so much to say you have the one to say, you know.
Yeah, it depends on how you define that. There are more that change from being naturalistic evolutionists to theistic evolutionists. But there are many who become, I would consider, creationists or young earth creationists. There are some. One notable one is a man named Dr. He's actually the one who is considered the father of the modern young earth creationist movement. His name is Dr. Henry Morris. He died around 2000. He founded the Institute for Creation Research. And he and Dwayne Gish were there for a long time. Anyway, he passed away. That organization is still going on. He was in a number of universities. He was department head in a department at Virginia Tech, and he used to be an evolutionist. And but he was a very honest guy, too. So if you study the history of this guy, he went around and he started seeing problems with it, and he started asking people. And he said no one had any answers for the questions he was asking. And anyway, there are a number more like that. I think Gary Parker. And for those who weren't here, every week I put some recommended books in the back. If you want to buy any books, these are the ones I would invest your money in, because they are very succinct. and put a lot of information in there. One of those is one by Henry Morris. It's the Creation Trilogy, Volume 2, Creation, or the Bible, or Creation and Science. And he's just done an amazing guy, very prolific. Anyway, there are a lot of those guys. If you go to the Answers in Genesis website, they have a list of all the famous, most famous creationist scientists from the present all the way back to at least the 16th century.